I see people busily working behind the glass, so I'm hesitant to begin. You know what? I think if you looked at our website or just heard a little bit, I think the shows we've just been on there not too long, but we do a wide variety of subjects. You know, I like to say this is not a show about religion, but about life, and then asking certain kinds of questions different aspects of life, and getting at some of these, some of the really essential questions behind the religious endeavor, like what does it mean to be human, and how can we illuminate that with all of our disciplines and faculties. So I think this is a great subject, and frankly, right here at the end of July on this hot day in Minnesota, I think it's a perfect subject.
Yeah, I do too. Too bad you're in the studio and not out swimming in Minnetonka or the Mississippi River or something.
I'll be out swimming after we finish here. Okay,
good.
I just got a thumbs up. And
good.
Where I'd like to start with you is where I start with every interview, whatever the subject is. I'd like to just hear a little bit about the spiritual background of your life. Let's say your background spiritually, as well as your background of a person who plays.
Well, I'm reasonably old, and I'm sorry we've only got 90 minutes.
I did see somewhere you made a reference to Midwestern Presbyterians, I believe speaking of your parents, and they're not famous for their playfulness.
Well, they were Midwestern Presbyterians. I grew up on the southwest side of Chicago, and my mother was one of the trustees of the Moody Bible Institute.
Oh, wow.
My father was an organic chemist, an inventive fellow, very playful. So I grew up in an atmosphere that had kind of free play and also religious overtones. I did go to a parochial high school called Christian High and then to Wheaton College.
Mm-hmm.
So I had a certain sense of deep belief, and I reveled in that deep belief, which was certainly a part of my religious background, and I would say my spiritual heritage.
Mm-hmm.
And then I went off to medical school, and through a
series
of residencies.
Did you become a psychiatrist? You specialized?
Well, what I did, Krista, was I initially graduated from medical school, took a rotating general internship, and then did essentially family practice for 3 years.
Okay.
Liked it. Wanted to sort of deepen my diagnostic skills, so I went back to the Midwest in your state, to the Mayo Clinic, and took a fellowship in internal medicine. And while I was doing that, the dean at Baylor, who I'd been a friend of when I was a student, called me there to be an assistant dean. And when I got down there, a marvelous psychiatrist by the name of Sherbert Fraser was sure that my mental health would be improved if I took a residency in psychiatry. So
okay.
I did that.
All right.
So that's how I got to psychiatry, kind of a circuitous route.
And in your history, there is a quite striking and surprising straight line, it seems, between your interest in play and an early psychiatric study you became involved in extreme violence. Tell me about that line.
Well, that line, of course, opened play up to me in a very unexpected way. In 1966, when I was just beginning to take over an office as an assistant professor of psychiatry, a young man by the name of Charles Whitman went up to the Texas Tower in Austin, Texas, after killing his wife and mother, and perpetrated what was then the largest mass murder in the history of the United States, killing 17 additional people and wounding 41. And because I had done some studies of violence in the course of my residency in neurology and psychiatry, and because in August in Texas most people who are important are elsewhere, I was put in charge of the behavioral aspect of trying to figure out why Charles Whitman did this horrendous crime. And we had at our beck and call all the resources of the state of Texas that were being pressured by the then Governor John Connally, who had been in the Kennedy motorcade, fearing at that particular era, which was a turbulent era in our history.
1966, I think, right?
Right.
Mm-hmm.
Very turbulent time in our history, that there were Charles Whitmans or Oswalds on every corner.
I see.
So sparing no expense, we brought in the world's experts to try and figure out the motivation of Charles Whitman, even though he had been killed by vigilante crossfire at the top of the tower. Mm. And so for a very intense period of time, in addition to doing very detailed toxicologic and studies of his body, we retrieved as much information as possible from his prenatal era all the way up till the last hours before he died. And without going through that entire story, mm-hmm. one of the major conclusions, which struck me and has certainly stuck with me since, was that a remarkably systematic suppression of any free play, which was largely the result of his father's overbearing and intense personality, prevented Charles Whitman from engaging in normal play at virtually any era of his life, including his early infancy, to where one would expect that even an overbearing father would have allowed the mother and infant to have enjoyed each other together, but he didn't. Whenever he could, he stopped any kind of spontaneity between them.
Now, did you then continue on and find that to be a factor in the lives of other violent individuals, homicidal individuals?
Yes, I did. We thought at the end of the Whitman study that this was such a bizarre aberration in human behavior that it probably was not something one could generalize from. So as a result of the funding available and the availability of research subjects in the prison system in Texas, a team of us then studied all the young murderers whose crime was essentially homicide without their being career criminals. And we did an in-depth study of them, their families, and compared them to as well-matched a control and comparison population as we could. And lo and behold, we discovered that the majority of them, in fact 90% level, had really bizarre, absent, deficient, seriously deviant play histories.
Now, is that just one symptom among others of other kinds of abuse or neglect? Or did it seem to be a quality of these lives sort of in and of itself?
Well, I don't know that I can answer that question specifically because abuse was certainly a part of the homicidal population, mm-hmm. both Whitman and the young murderers we studied. But if you sequentially sort of watch a life emerge and you look at what play offers from early infancy into adulthood, when crucial experiences are missed, the ability to regulate emotions and to establish empathy and to live with trust with one's companions is definitely attenuated or definitely constricted. So that from my standpoint, although there are other factors that are certainly certainly allow one to have a proclivity for violence, the play history and its aberrations or lack have proven the test of time to be extremely important in the life cycle of highly violent men, at least.
Let's talk about what you mean when you use the word play. When it's something that you associate so closely with words like empathy and trust. You know, what's your working mm-hmm. definition?
go to the Oxford Dictionary and you'll find at least 50 definitions. But to start with, I'd say play is anything that spontaneously is done for its own sake. And then one can extend that into more and more detailed definitions such as appears purposeless, produces pleasure and joy, leads one to the next stage of mastery, is in terms of biology, appears to be the product of what I call divinely superfluous neurons. There is choice
right.
In the player's life, and that choice, if given opportunities through the environment, emerges innately and spontaneously if the individual or animal, for that matter, that's capable of playing is safe and well-fed.
You know, you said appears purposeless, and I'm thinking of what difficulty some parts of our culture have with anything that appears purposeless.
So true.
I mean, I probably would put myself in this category at certain points in my life. But something that appears purposeless would probably lead to anxiety rather than joy for me.
Well, I hope not. I hope part of the outcome of this discussion with you and your audience is a little guilt-free purposelessness.
Okay. And you mentioned animals, and it is very intriguing to look at the work you do with the National Institute for Play, but also how much you've been involved in the science of play, which encompasses both animals and human beings. When I use that phrase, the science of play, you know, what comes to mind for you? There's this whole world, this whole universe of a different kind of science that you have been immersed in that the rest of us probably don't even know about.
Well, I think that's true, and I think that's the science of play, and having had a background in medicine and psychiatry and neurology, primed me, I think, to see play behavior in its evolutionary terms, so that when I had the option fairly late in my career of studying play in a broad sense, I started with the animals in the wild and learned a huge amount about sort of the spectrum of play behavior in the animal world.
I think I've looked at some projects you were involved in, an issue of National Geographic, some of the visuals on sites around your work, and there are these remarkable images of cheetahs and cranes and bears and mountain goats who seem clearly to be playing.
Well, I think there's no doubt, at least to us onlookers, that they're playing, and my guess is, by all the measurements we can make on the animals, they actually are playing. It's a different and definable state of being than any other.
Mm-hmm. And to say some more about what the qualities of that state of being are. And what do we know about it through science?
Well, I think we know a lot about it through the wonderful laboratory rat. If you are a reader of the New York Times, a recent article by Natalie Anger talked about sort of the personality differences and how intricate rats are. But they have a very specific language of play which is measurable and which is like none other. They make a particular squeak that's inaudible to humans as a signal that they want to play. They then wrestle with each other and pin each other, particularly during their juvenile times. They engage in what a number of investigators call hardwired rough-and-tumble play. And the outcome of that is quite striking, because if the laboratory investigator of play stops the rats specifically from playing, there are some dire consequences. They do not socialize normally. They can't recognize friend from foe. And there are other very specific kinds of outcomes, which, to my way of thinking, to some degree match some of the human outcomes. But, of course, they're in rat language, and mm-hmm. human outcomes are much more intricate.
So what is happening in play that enables it to have that effect on, I don't know, animal development or even human lives? What do we understand about this?
Well, I don't think we understand enough, because the cultural heritage we have is kind of like your guilt.
Yeah,
it is that play is trivial. It's for what you do when your responsibilities are taken care of, particularly as an adult. So it hasn't had the funding or the close look that other elements of behavior that are important have had in a scientific sense. But if you were to follow, as I have at least scholastically, and if not clinically, if you were to follow the trail of play in both animals and humans, the beginning point of play in the mother-infant or parent-infant bonding process is kind of the spontaneous eruption of joy and pleasure upon the process of being safely fed. And in the case of the human, when there is eye contact and the social smile emerges in the infant and the mother begins to coo, mm-hmm. that coo, and that's worldwide, and there is mutual joy, and the brain imaging that's associated with that shows an attunement between the mother's right cortex, the non-dominant hemisphere of the brain, and the babies. And then if you build on that and say, okay, the child has experienced that, now they're growing up a little bit, they get some of the same joyful experience from grabbing something, putting it in their mouths when they're infants, and then a little later playing with toys, and then ultimately parallel play with other children, and on and on. I could go right on up through the whole life cycle, each of which has more and more intricate, more complex play if the individual is sort of allowed through the environment to take advantage of it, of that opportunity.
I mean, here's a statement. This was from an interview you did with a scientist, Bob Fagan, who studies mammals and birds, bears in particular. And you asked him about the play of bears. And, you know, one answer he gave you was they play because it's fun. And then you probed. And he said also, in a world continuously presenting unique challenges and ambiguity, play prepares them for an evolving planet. I mean, that's a huge idea. And I think you've said something similar about how play equips human beings to live in the world. But can you explain that to me more? What is the connection between play and that kind of?
Well, I think again, this the part of the reason that I pursued a brilliant field scientist like Bob was I was trying to figure out the same question you're asking, because even as a trained psychiatrist, I couldn't really figure out where it came from, why it's there.
Yeah.
But when you see animals and humans who are deprived of it, they are fixed and rigid in their responses to complex stimuli. They don't have a repertoire of choices that are as broad as their intelligence should allow them to have. And they don't seek out novelty and newness, which is part of an essential aspect of play both in animals and humans. So if you look at the human situation, at least for the last 200,000 years or so, our capacity as a species to adapt to, whether we're in the Arctic or the tropics, the desert or a rainforest, appears to me to be related significantly to our capacity in as developing creatures to play. And then if you look more closely at the human being, as Bob Fagan and I have done both through bears and through looking at bears and analyzing the background of human and non-human primates, you find that the human being really is designed biologically to play throughout the life cycle. And from my standpoint as a clinician, when one really doesn't play at all or very little in adulthood, there are consequences: rigidities, depression, lack of adaptability, no irony, you know, things that are pretty important that enable us to cope in a world of many demands.
That's kind of interesting, because the last statement you made makes a lot of sense to me. You know, it sounds logical. I mean, in that last statement, I suddenly think of adults I know who fall into both categories, and you're describing something that's kind of obvious, but that I haven't ever stopped to put words around.
Well, it is obvious, but there are capacities for succeeding in our culture by being compulsive and kind of a grinder, so you can get economic rewards. But those people that surround the grinder are generally not very happy, nor is the interior life of the grinder very happy. So, you know.
Yeah. Let's talk about children for a minute, and then I do want to talk about adults. But I'm interested in the fine line that I think perhaps is more apparent when you're studying animals or children between playing and fighting, or right? And
right.
So as the mother of a son, and I didn't have this experience with my daughter, but with my son, I do see how he has this rich fantasy life. It's often kind of playing with himself, although there are all kinds of characters in the room who I can't see.
That's wonderful.
Right?
That's good news.
Okay. But I've named it what he does, saving the world, right? So when he says, I need to go save the world, which is a really nice spin I've put on it. But there's a certain violence, there's a combativeness to it. And apparently that's quite common as well.
It's universal if it's allowed to emerge.
So what is that about? Yeah.
Well, let me sort of go on a riff about rough and tumble play.
Okay.
Which occurs in children both genders, but is a bit more obvious usually in boys. And about your, how old is your son?
He's 9, and he's been doing this for several years.
Sure. Well, if you were to observe kids like in a preschool that are involved with all the exuberance that preschool kids have, age 4, 3, 4, 5, and you watch them at play, it's chaotic, anarchic, looks violent to the surface.
Mm-hmm.
They're diving, they're hitting, they're squealing, they're screaming. But if you look at them, they're smiling at each other. And they don't. It's not a contest of who's going to win. And most well-meaning parents and certainly a lot of preschool teachers put the lid on that because
yeah.
it's scary. It's scary for an adult because they don't remember it. And it almost always has pretense and real. It has violence and fantasy. And it is the borderland between inside and outside and making sense of the world. It's a very important part of free play, driven from within by the child's own personality and temperament, and mixing with others. Now, you were surprised when I said things like empathy and trust earlier in our discussion. But think about this. If you are in a rough and tumble situation and somebody hits you too hard, you know what that feels like. So you're not going to hit somebody else too hard, because you know what it feels like. And that's sort of that's the roots, for example, of an empathic response. And the thing, none of the murderers I studied engaged in normal rough and tumble play. Hmm. Absolutely none. And and if you extrapolate the rough and tumble play backwards into animals, they also appear to need it to be able to properly find their place in the troop or the tribe or the pack and develop social reality to meet their needs.
So your son
sounds like he's doing what's pretty normal stuff, and I think there has to be reasonable protection by adults, but not the kind of helicopter parent hovering over the situation, which prevents the spontaneity from occurring and the kids from solving their own problems that are age appropriate for them.
I think that's really interesting that even what looks like potentially violent play or, can look dangerous is also a source of learning about empathy and boundaries, I guess.
Sure. Well, they're imposed. And most mm-hmm. kids who have had a not too toxic or sadistic bully in their midst will gang up on the bully and take care of him.
Mm.
And the bully learns. If the bully spends too much time not experiencing normal rough and tumble play, or if the taboos of violence are broken again and again in the home of the bully, then the bully's got to be removed from the play situation or they will upset and upend the whole playground. But in general, the kids solve their own problems, and that's one of the most important things they learn about themselves.
Hmm.
They learn whether they're strong or not so strong, fast or cagey, verbal or nonverbal, imaginative or something else, and you learn that generally on the way up sequentially throughout your childhood.
Hmm. And in our culture, there's also this, in some of what you write and the other people you're in conversation with, you make a distinction between play and contest or competition. Mm-hmm. Although I think in our culture, the two often become almost indistinguishable or they become entangled. And maybe adults even impose that on children's play.
This is certainly a sticky wicket. But in trying to sort of organize my thinking about competition and contest,
mm-hmm.
This is where I go back to what appears to occur in nature and what appears to be kind of a natural process developmentally in those children who appear to be having a very normal background in play without too much imposition of cultural pressures on the part of the culture of the parents. And what one sees in general is a natural emergence of competitive activity, and by that testing, I mean testing one skill against the skill of another,
right,
without the necessity of domination. And so that quality of competition appears to be pretty universal in cliques in girls and in sometimes kind of physical prowess in boys and now in both genders also. Whereas contest, I think, requires a winner, often has a exclusionary quality to it, and is not what you see in animal play in the high primates in nature.
Really?
You'll see handicapping that occurs spontaneously in nature, in which the stronger person allows or handicaps the weaker individual so that the play can continue. If there's a chase, often the chaser becomes a chasee. There isn't chasing somebody down and then putting him down. So those are sort of the natural history of play in the wild. Now, and I think it is possible for a wise coach or a seasoned parent to deal with a competition in, let's say, in your son's age, for example, age 9, where mutual participation, love of the game, personal best, there are ways of dealing with this, and the National Institute for Play has an affiliate that's gifted at this in the Colorado Front Range, a gifted volunteer coach by the name of Gary Avicius, who has developed a whole curriculum which assists both parents and coaches to keep this volunteer sports going without it being super contest particularly at the younger ages.
Right. I think you make a very interesting and intriguing point about the scientists themselves who you have interacted with over the years. Jane Goodall in Africa.
Mm-hmm.
You mentioned Bob Fagan. You mentioned some others, Mark Beckhoff, Irenaeus Eibelsfeld. These are all people who study play in animals. And you've written, I believe, their immersion in wild play or natural play has altered them. Say some more about that.
Well, I know particularly Jane, Mark, and Bob very well. And Jane certainly was altered by the prolonged exposure and the slow habituation of the chimpanzees in Gombe when she was, what some people the National Geographic called Eve in Eden,
mm-hmm.
but where she saw and took in particular, the mother-infant play of chimpanzees and has written some beautiful scientific essays about this and about the qualities that are induced. And when one talks to her about this, she takes on kind of a... I won't call it ethereal, but it's sort of a knowingness that this is something in nature that's beautiful and appropriate and can be incorporated in its own language for humans. And then I go to Bob Fagan, who's with the bears in the wild for years and years and steeped in, and I've been with him in Alaska up in a tree hour after hour watching bear play. And Bob has a kind of a spiritual aesthetic about play that permeates his life. And I think, I've never really tested this in any way because it would have been inappropriate. But I think that there's a certain quality of optimism and compassion that has occurred through the systematic observation of play over a lifetime. Certainly that's the case with Mark Beckhoff, whose writings on animal ethics and human ethics and the origins of morality stem from his long exposure in the wild to coyote play and other animals at play. So I've been very impressed that by immersing oneself in the study of play, there is a certain either permission or osmosis that occurs that's good for us.
Mm-hmm. And this connection of play with spirituality, ethics, morality, those are words you've just used. You also have been, it seems at one point, were very formed by the work of Joseph Campbell. Could you say something about how that your sense of that connection has evolved for you, both as a scholar and sort of in life?
Well, I'll put it in perspective if I can, because mm-hmm. it's a fairly complex personal story. But in short, about 5 or 6 years after the Whitman episode, I felt that I was beginning to lose some of the linkages that made sense. So I got a fellowship and went back to Harvard with the man who'd been my boss at Baylor, and had a fellowship there with no required chores. And so I was simultaneously writing up and dealing with the origins of violence and dealing with Whitman, and at the same time reading all of the major works of Joseph Campbell. And what I felt from the encounter with Campbell then was a freedom from the literalness that my biblical heritage and Wheaton heritage had taught me, and a freedom to feel more the commonality of all religious strivings of all mankind and humankind through the ages, and the art and the stories and the historic perspectives of Campbell's scholarship really spoke to me. So I felt that was something very important. And then while I was looking at Whitman simultaneously, it became evident to me that Whitman had lost what little control he had over his impulses as he lost his Catholicism. And that although he didn't have an internalized conscience structure that was very distinct, as long as he had the rituals and the belief and the practice of the church, he seemed to be able to be part of a community. Yeah. But he got disillusioned with that, both in the service and I think through the violence of his father. And then is when he appeared to fragment in his diaries and elsewhere. So I began to link the importance of a believed mythology, whether one calls their spiritual belief a myth or not. I'm not trying to insult anybody, but I think it's a way of describing a deep belief. A loss of that is a loss of something very, very significant to be human. Now, segue another 10 or 15 years, and I'm out of my clinical practice, and I'm beginning to try and think, well, what's really important to me? And then I started musing about how if your play is not healthy and not intricate, your myth won't be. You'll be enacting your mythic life in a way that's probably got some pathology. So it's pretty important to get play right, because play is more basic and more necessary in our development, to my way of thinking, than myth. I mean, it's not that we don't have to have a spiritual basis from our morality and our being, but I hope that puts it in some kind of perspective for you. Anyhow.
But give me an example or tell a story about what you mean about when you say something like, if we don't get our play right, we don't get our myth right. I mean,
well, okay, if you think about what play produces, and I've given you a few things like empathy and trust, but you watch what you mentioned about your 9-year-old son dealing with fantasy and the internalization of his narratives, his own story about making sense of the world. What play does for kids is internalize these narratives that are their own private storytelling to make the world make sense, which is a fragmentary myth. You know, it's a belief system that the kid operates under. I mean, I've got a bunch of grandchildren. I love listening to them struggle to make sense of their world.
Right.
If you just sort of listen, you hear this. Well, to me, if they've had abuse or deprivation or media saturation that is violent highly pathological experiences in their play experience, then their internal narratives are not going to be very balanced. They're not going to have a means of making sense of themselves or the world.
Okay.
And when they don't, I think they're at a disadvantage when they then embrace a religion. That's kind of a personalized view. I mean,
okay.
It's pretty...
Mm-hmm.
Does that make sense to
you?
Yeah,
it does, and I think we'll keep teasing it out. I want to name something that you talked about as scientists, and I'm sensing this applies to you too, that the more you expose yourself to play, that it affects you, it changes you. And to me, one of the most wonderful gifts of becoming a parent is that I get a second chance to be playful?
You bet.
And I actually think I wasn't so good at it as a child, and I'm, you know, I mean, but mm-hmm. I think I have a richer play life sort of with, in watching my children, I'm more joyful in a way, even vicariously with them, and that's an amazing second chance.
Well, they're the professionals, we're not.
Right.
They're the ones who are purer in their play than we as adults are. So you're right on. And, you know, being a grandparent, you get a third chance.
Yeah. But it awakens, I do become aware that it awakens something in me, right? That is
sure.
also part of being human. And it enriches me to be exposed to that, for that to be part of my life again.
Well, it's relearning the languages that are fundamental to play, which are largely nonverbal and emotional and really fairly specific. When you relearn those languages, just like the mother looking at her smiling child, you get a spontaneous burst of pleasure,
mm-hmm.
and that's pretty important.
There's a lot of concern right now, and I know you've been quoted. You were quoted in a New York Times article. Like, what was the title of that? Something about... putting the skinned knees back in playtime, about how in our culture, you know, as you and I discussed a bit, there's a tendency to clamp down on what looks too wild or dangerous.
For sure.
Yeah. From what you know and what you study and your sense of what play means in human life, what's your take on that and how it's affecting
Well, this is a tough one because I don't want to foster, broken bones and concussions and that sort of thing in kids. But an inherent part of being playful is taking risk.
Mm-hmm.
What you don't want to do is have the risks be excessive. And the natural history of play in the world, both animal and human, is that persistent play increases the risk of death and damage while it's taking place, but it appears to be absolutely necessary for the well-being and, say, future of the species. So it is it's a conundrum, but it definitely, to remove risk, all risk from kids' play is to not allow them the spontaneity from within to develop themselves. So it's a judgment call on the part of parents.
Mm-hmm.
And I think this is where I have some beef with the media, in that I think if it bleeds, it leads. The perceptions of the levels of violence and risk in our culture are really beyond what the actual risks are, so that a responsible parent feels they can't let their kid be out on the streets in
right.
the afternoon and that sort of thing.
Right. And what I kind of hear you saying, I mean, here's a quote from something Jane Goodall said, and play teaches young animals what they can and cannot do at a time when they are relatively free from the survival pressures of adult life. But I feel like we are so obsessed, and I'm, you know, speaking for myself as well, with our children's safety, and so fearful that they don't get that freedom, our children.
Very true. And I think there are some heartening playground movements both in Europe and in the U.S. where the playgrounds are going to be not so sterile.
Mm-hmm.
And allow, I mean, the fact that there are no teeter-totters and most of the swings don't really go very far, et cetera, and the monkey bars can only be 3 feet high. It's reasonable to have safe playgrounds, but it's also reasonable to have challenging playgrounds. And I think the balance, to develop that balance, is a skill that's now becoming part of architectural schools, and I know there are some corporate interests in Europe that are trying to develop multi-ethnic playgrounds so that some of the ethnic tensions will be dealt with in a playground way when the kids are small.
Hmm. I mean, I kind of hear you putting a point on this, though, and saying it's not, you know, that we're keeping their bodies safe and endangering their souls if we don't let them take some risks and be more playful.
No question about it. And I think... I think it's safer for the person who is a player to take a few hard knocks and maybe have a fracture in childhood than it is to insulate them from the possibility of that. I think that constricts their psyches and their futures much more.
Hmm. You've even said that play rewards and directs the living of life in accord with innate talents. How does that work? How do you see that?
Well, I could ask you as a parent and any other parent that's listening with a young child, mm-hmm. Say a child over 3 but under 12, and if you just observe them and don't try and direct them and watch what it is they like to do in play and get some sense of how their temperament intermixes with their play desires, you often will see a key to their innate talents. And if those talents are given fairly free rein, and this I've done through a lot of clinical study of the histories of people who, some of whom played and some of who haven't, if you allow those innate talents to build upon themselves and the environment is favorable enough so that it supports that, then the sense of empowerment and freedom, such as a premier musician or a prime athlete that's joyful in their athleticism, or the writer who's imaginative and full of J.K. Rowling, mm-hmm. and I think that then you see that there is a union between self and talent, and that this is nature's way of sort of saying this is who you are and what you are. Mm. And I'm sure I'm reasonably sure if you go back and think about both of your children or yourself and go back to your earliest emotion-laden visual and visceral memories of what really gave you joy, you'll have some sense of what was natural for you and where your talents lie. Hmm. And so that's why I write that. Hmm. I think it's pretty important.
Yeah. Do you... I think it's fashionable to say that media is ruining our children and they watch too much TV and video games are ruining them. And it's certainly... I think one effect of keeping our children safe indoors is that we kind of make them captive to technology. That can be one effect. But I will say that as I look at some of the computer and internet-based games that my children discover, some of them are incredibly interactive, and there's a lot of imagination.
Sure.
I mean, is some of that okay?
Oh, sure. Well, of course. I mean, I, the research is not very good, in my view. On the effects, it is pretty good on the effects of violent TV, for example,
right.
Prolonged exposure to violent TV. But the research on video games, particularly if it's kind of non-addictive video game use, is not very solid. And I think there is evidence that a limited amount, by limited, I don't know exactly that I could give you a figure on that, mm-hmm. but a limited amount of video games probably increases imaginativeness and skills, and the newly designed video games that incorporate movement are likely to be much more savory for the body and mind than, let's say, one that's strictly two-dimensional screen and your thumbs on a gadget.
Mm-hmm. Is the involvement of the body generally really important in terms of the positive effects that you've noted in play in animals and people?
Absolutely. I'm glad you asked the question. Part of the brain called the cerebellum, at least when I went to medical school, was thought to just help coordinate eye movement and body balance, and there were tests just that one made neurologically to see if the cerebellum is intact. Now, with refined imaging techniques, we see that three-dimensional movement in space with some gravitational G-forces that are a part of that stimulates the cerebellum. There are connections between the cerebellum and the prefrontal cortex that get lit up by three-dimensional movement. And there's every evidence that movement accelerates learning. And this is in its infancy, but there's enough evidence for this that these are parts of studies that the National Institute for Play is attempting to organize because it seems to be very important. And to take this a step further, there are other brain imaging studies that show that the brain responds differently to a two-dimensional image, let's say a hand grasping a ball that's on a photograph, mm-hmm. than from an actual hand grasping a ball in the presence of the onlooker. And the actual hand and ball open up many more associational areas of the brain, and therefore the assumption is to more rich integration of that image than the two-dimensional image, and that's a fundamental part of our biological design that we're stuck with because it's been around for a few million years.
Okay. I mean, I'm struck that we're having this very serious conversation about play.
Well, this is serious, you know. We don't want to have any mischief happening on this program.
That's right. I mean, tell me how this research and this immersion that you have in play as a study, how does it change your experience of this part of life? How does it change you?
Well, I give myself over at least 3 or 4 hours a day to what, for an old guy, is spontaneous free play. It could be reading or what I would call as extremely low-quality rogue tennis, hiking, yeah, playing with grandchildren. But, if a day goes by and I haven't at this age had some sense of timelessness and freedom and purposelessness, I'll probably be kind of ratty by supper time.
But, boy, cultivating an appreciation for timelessness and purposelessness, mm-hmm, I mean, that's work in our culture.
Shouldn't be. Should be a part of our you attenuate recess, cut down recess, and kids are learning that what's important is academic performance, mm-hmm, whereas probably equal amounts, if not more, are being learned on the playground at recess. So, that most kids are outside of time when they're on the playground at recess if it's free play.
Say some more about that, what you mean, outside of time. I mean, that's such an evocative phrase.
Well, if one were to get a replay of Michael Jordan in one of the final games of NBA championship and see him zoning down the floor, doing some moves he's never done before and tossing the ball up for a basket, I doubt if at that time he has really conscious that the buzzer's about to go or that I think he's outside of time. Hmm. And I can certainly give you from my own life recollections of that sensation. Last week I was in a nice musical concert that was being held in Monterey, and, I got lost in the music and had the feeling of, sort of an oceanic feeling of not being there. And it wasn't something I expected to happen, but it was pleasurable, and and watching a grandson of mine on the floor with his stuffed animal talking to it, timeless. They're not in a, and it's different for lots of us. But I think that's a, play state of being. That's an important sense of priority that you don't try and struggle toward, but you try and sort of let it happen to yourself from within what works for you.
Hmm. You did mention reading, and I don't know if I would, if reading would fall into a definition of play, but it is something for me that's very pleasurable and transports me to a timeless place. Does reading count for you?
Oh, of course, yeah. Very much so, and I share that same weakness.
when you talk about timelessness, that does have spiritual resonance. How do you think about the spirituality of play? Or maybe you would put other words on it, but.
Well, I don't know that I have a crisp way of thinking about it. I can give you a private experience that was, to me, a spiritual experience. Mm-hmm. When I was working with the National Geographic and privileged to spend time with play researchers in Africa, I do vividly remember one morning when I was watching a pride of lions and two sub-adult female lionesses got up, looked at each other, and there's a picture of these in the National Geographic magazine, what looked from a distance kind of like a fight, but it was a ballet. And while I was watching this, I was overwhelmed by the feeling that this is, I'm almost brought to tears talking about it now, that this is divine. There's something divine going on here that transcends their carnivorousness and the, you know, red in tooth and claw and the rest of it. Now, that's my projection onto it, but it still was very meaningful to me. Hmm. So that, and I think seeing a young child in just immersed in play and watching them closely is a spiritual experience, and there is spirit emerging in play, something non-material that's a part of it that at least it's hard for me to define it as just ions zipping around in a nervous system.
Right, and I mean, if you are a religious person, I mean, do you have a different image of God because of this?
Yes,
well,
I do.
What does it do to your image of God to be a lover of play?
Well, I think, you know, I've got, since I'm, one foot is always stuck in science, I have some sense that this is God's way of evolving, of things evolving in our biological universe, that some of the driving force behind change is embodied in this emergent property, this self-organizing system that tends to captivate the nervous system and the behavior of humans, but that I call play. Hmm. And that, for me, expands and kind of gives me a sense of unity with time and space and permanence and even the galaxies, which are also self-organizing and emergent.
It's a very pleasant way for God to organize self-organization.
Well, there's also violence, and there are a few other things one sees that I don't want to be Pollyannish about it, because I've certainly seen the world in its, you can't, as a psychiatrist or a studier of violence, not see the other side, which I've seen too.
Mm-hmm. But this is part of the big picture. This
sure is
also part of the big picture. I mean, we get a lot of publicity of that other, of the violence, right?
I'll say we do. And it's there. It's real. There's no shrinking from it.
Mm-hmm. What would you like to talk about? What have I not asked you about that animates you in this, that you want to share with people?
Well, I think the sense that if you're living a life without it, yeah, your life can go on okay. It's you're going to survive. You're not going to die if you don't
without
play.
Without it, with play, right.
Without play. Mm-hmm. But it's kind of an endurance contest, or the joy of living is lessened if one doesn't play. And in particular, if parents are tense and over-organizing their kids with the hope they'll succeed, get into Princeton, make a lot of money, so that they insist that every moment be play dates or soccer or ballet or gymnastics or, you know, music here, that some of the essence of life is being missed.
Mm-hmm.
And that's one thing, and that's important to me. And probably the other thing that we haven't talked about, but which has really struck me since I've been a student of play, is looking at the biological design of being human. And when you look closely at that, I'll give you an analogy. A Labrador retriever plays through its lifetime and dies a child.
Hmm.
A wolf sort of gives up childish things, double scent marks, has alpha behavior, governs its reproduction, and is a very successful animal if it isn't killed off by humans, but doesn't play much. There is a fixed kind of property that the wolf has. Now, if you look at our primate heritage, chimpanzees, bonobos, orangutans, mountain gorillas, our closest relatives by DNA, they all have a more fixed kind of wolf-like adulthood. But if you look at the human and look at our nervous systems and our, what I would call our physiognomy, the way we look and the way we're designed,
right,
we really are designed to retain immature, playful-like attributes throughout our life cycle. That's a fundamental part of our design. We know that human beings are now capable of neurogenesis, of new neural development throughout the lifetime, whereas most other creatures cannot. So that's a design part of being human. Now take that into policy matters.
Mm-hmm.
Do we parent that way? Do we teach our kids in school that way? Do we take advantage of the design? Do we also see that there are hazards? The permanent adolescence of the human being means we may be subject to irrational, impulsive behavior. Maybe our laws and our institutions should help reflect that a bit more. If we don't play, what are the consequences? We're more reptilian. More savage. We lack some of those features that I've mentioned earlier in the program. So these are things that I think are embedded in good science, but haven't yet made it into mainstream science or mainstream policy. And that's why I established the National Institute for Play, was to try and bring some of these concepts together and bring some experts together who are much more reliable scientists than am I, so we can test this out and begin to see if public policy in terms of personal relationships and health and education and parenting and even corporate leadership can begin to embrace play more and benefit from it. So that's my soapbox.
I think that in making a connection between play and maturity and wisdom, because, you know, that's something I hear, you're affirming, I think, one of the most surprising experiences I've had of enjoying growing older, you know, sort of heading into the latter part of my 40s, which is that I actually think I am enjoying life more and relaxing.
And good for you.
And throwing myself into play in a way that I didn't when I was younger and, you know, accomplishing things. Hopefully I'm still accomplishing things. Sorry, what?
You've gained wisdom earlier than most of us. I certainly was a workaholic doctor for too long in my life.
Right, but I mean, that is the model in our culture of what being mature is. I mean, being mature is being that wolf. It's leaving behind that Labrador behavior. I mean, clearly,
correct.
I know what you're saying. There's a line between being a permanent adolescent and being a playful, mature human being. But I think you're right that our culture doesn't know how to talk about that playfulness as wisdom. Kind of.
There is a kind of a paradox in it. It doesn't mean we should be irresponsible.
Mm-hmm.
Just the opposite. By having empathy, I think one, and trust, one, and compassion, which I think are byproducts of the playful life, because you got a little left over. It doesn't mean that you're just going to go off and do whatever you want hedonistically. There are boundaries that are certainly part of play. But it doesn't mean you have to be grouch or serious all the time. I mean, look at Reagan and Gorbachev at the SALT missile here, talks in Iceland. They broke down completely until the morning they were to leave. Reagan had said, let's have breakfast together. And he went in and started telling dirty jokes, and then Gorby started telling dirty jokes. They reorganized the conference, and they got the missile situation taken care of.
That's hard to turn into a paradigm, though.
Yes, I know. I don't expect us to do that with the Iranians at the moment.
I think this is important. I mean, I remember being, so here's a question I would ask you, what advice you would give people if they want to recover this as a healthy, wise aspect of being human. I remember being at a retreat once. I think it was a spiritual retreat, very serious. And I remember some people saying how one of the things they were working at this point in their life was playing more. And something about the way they said it, about what hard work it was, made it feel like a doomed enterprise. I worry a little bit. We've now kind of rediscovered, we're having this conversation about our children, but are we going to make them work so hard at playing that we ruin it for them? So, I mean, what advice would you give people about recovering this as a healthy part of our lives, if it's something that we've lost and that our culture really, really works against for us?
I think recovering it depends a little on how much of it you had as a kid and you can bring back in adult form into your current contemporary life. you know, I take a lot of reviews of play of varieties of people. And when I come across somebody who really has had an abusive childhood and they say, well, I've never really played, I've never felt free to play, it's not that they've lost it, they feel they've never had it.
Yeah.
Well, then you start with things like rhythm and movement and those things that intrinsically produce some sense of pleasure and joyfulness. And often, you know, just, well, as Bob Fagan says, movement fills an empty heart.
Like movement, dancing, or sports, dancing, or anything?
Yeah, dancing, but things that are conflict-free, but that you can kind of do, that produce a sense of some of the things I've talked about, a sense of pleasure, of taking you out of the urgency of time, that work for you, whether it's reading or dancing or hiking or conversation in a pub or what, you know, there are lots of different ways. But I think it's important to find those things that work for you and to then, as Campbell said, then follow your bliss. Mm-hmm. Find your bliss and follow it. But the bliss is usually retrievable. It's kind of like you have to reach for it and pull it out, you know, from within your memory. But reach into visual images and emotional images that produce a sense of pleasure for you, and then build on them. And that usually helps in the recovery. And it's not something that happens overnight. It's a, you know, it's a slow but enjoyable process.
Something to look forward to. Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
I think that's helpful. I want to ask my producers behind the glass if they have any questions, so I'm going to be quiet for a minute while I'm listening to them.
Okay.
Right. Okay, that's great. Okay, I've got some good questions.
Good.
You talked about, you gave an example of multi-ethnic playgrounds as one kind of innovative idea that's coming along. I wonder, you know, you make connections in your work between the absence of play and problems that we talk a lot about, larger social ills, especially around children, but not just children, depression, ADHD, obesity. Do you see other initiatives coming along that use these scientific insights into play also in addressing some of those big problems?
Yes, I do. I think there is some legislation pending. I don't have the HR and the Senate bills in front of me, but they are to mandate 60 minutes of physical exercise per day for elementary school kids, largely as a means of combating obesity. And they haven't, as far as I know, specified that during those 60 minutes that activity should be playful. But in my view, it's not going to stick if it's work. You know, if it's laps around the track and push-ups, forget it. The kids are going to look on that as punishment. If it's, on the other hand, highly intricate games that they can involve themselves in and that are physical, then that appears to me, my way of thinking, of being a favorable way to deal with the epidemic of obesity. So the question of ADHD is a tough one, because certainly as a psychiatrist who had some training in child and adolescent psychiatry, at the end of the spectrum of ADHD are some pretty clear, serious organic problems that probably are best treated with organic means, meaning pharmacologic means, which but they're the diagnostic criteria are specific and rare. At the other end of the spectrum is an exuberant 11-year-old boy who can't sit still in class, who, if you give Ritalin to that boy, ceases to play, but he's more calm, he's calmer. And one of our advisors to the National Institute for Play, Jacques Panksepp, who now is in Pullman, Washington, has done some remarkable studies, both in animals and a limited amount in human kids with ADHD, where vigorous play is being matched for similar kinds of ADHD against the use of pharmacologic agents, with the expectation or the hope that there'll be a positive outcome from those who are engaged in vigorous play, because the hypothesis is they'll continue to learn through play, whereas the kids who are medicated are not going to take advantage of as much of the positive benefits that play allows. So, you know, that's kind of a riff on ADHD and play.
You mentioned, I think it's a good point, of so logical and yet something we might miss when we try to legislate these things, that if we try to force physical activity as a to address obesity, it won't work, but if it's play, it might. This also reminds me of a big paradox that's quite visible in our culture right now as we speak. We celebrate professional athletes, you know, people whose bodies are peak condition and who entertain and achieve with their bodies, and yet there's so much controversy right now and scandal also surrounding those athletes not being healthy people, right? And how do you look at that and think about what that says about what we've done with play in our culture, or is it a completely different problem?
Well, I know a few professional athletes well, but I don't know any of these really celebrated athletes such as Barry Bonds and Gamby and people that are now getting huge amounts of press. But I think that the one of the questions I asked a man who's a photographer for the National Basketball Association was to please tell me who the most playful, truly playful participants in the National Basketball Association are. Long silence. And he said, you know, their lives are so skewed by money and pressures that they're, you know, he could name a few, and I don't know them well enough to put them on the air, give their names on the air now. But he was able to talk about a coach or two who he thought were playful. But I think the entertainment celebrity component of being a really big dog professional athlete makes it tough for them to stay playful. Mm. I think there are moments of play. I mentioned Michael Jordan earlier. Yeah. He's kind of a prototype of being in the zone and enjoying that. And I think I've looked at the life of Ozzie Smith, who played a lot as a kid before he was a baseball star. But I don't feel real wise about this particular group of individuals because I just haven't done the kind of in-depth examination of them like I have done, let's say, with many, many other populations of individuals.
So, yeah.
I think you've got a huge point that there are evidence of thuggishness and narcissism and people running roughshod over the law and feeling special. And, you know, you give a 19-year-old $40 million and it's pretty tough to stay normal. Yeah.
You're out there talking a lot. You've been at the PUSH conference, at the TED conference. How do you find your ideas being received among other kinds of leaders and innovators?
Whenever I do a one-on-one for an hour or so, the receipt, I would say, is very positive and life-changing, particularly if I have with me a gifted entertainer, a playful person who, in addition to my kind of cognitive, scientific, pedantic approach, allows the individual to experience some play while we're talking, kind of what you've talked about you know, here we are talking about it.
Well, it's like, who would you have with you, or what would be going on?
Well, I have a good friend and a colleague by the name of Bowen White. Bowen and Patch Adams work together. Bowen is a physician who has found a gift in being a clown, and he's not a mawkish clown. He's a clever, intuitive clown. He's written a book called Why Normal Isn't Healthy, and when he and I do a gig together, as we've done in a variety of corporations, the feedback I get a year later is really positive. It changed my life. I'm not doing the same kind of parenting. I'm spending more time. When I'm just the guy that's been talking, they remember that I've shown them the pictures of the wild polar bear and husky playing together, and they remember the Whitman case, but they haven't always changed their lives.
All right.
So, I would say I have a mixed experience with single speeches. I much prefer to be able to take the kind of in-depth the way we're doing to some degree here with a lot of visual support to show the story of play, particularly the evolution of play behavior in animals, the evolution of life, and then how this affects you and how it is very similar in its biology to the whole process of sleep and dreams. Mm. Everybody sleeps and dreams. That's a part of being human. It's a part of the animal world. Well, so is play. People don't think of it that way. And when I get the opportunity and personalize it for that individual's own culture and psychological needs, it has usually great effect, and it's accepted. But because there's so much cultural pressure that play is trivial, and the more you accomplish, the more grinder you're going to be, the better worker you're going to be. Mm. It's a big shift for a lot of people to think of it this way. And reminds me of one other thing. If you yourself, in the course of your life, have been valued primarily for your performance and your play has been suppressed, and you begin to see, emotionally at least, what you've missed, it's too much. Very often when I'm dealing with a lot of play, people start getting angry. And you say, what did I say? What did I do? And then you realize, my gosh, I'm beginning to tread on a part of their life. They've been valued only for their performance. They don't have an option other than that. You better shut up, Stuart, and let them alone. Hmm. So that's been a very, very common experience, particularly if I'm dealing with extremely high-performing executives.
Right. Well, then you're pointing up something where they're not accomplished at all, and that. I think that's why I asked you the question also about how people listening might cultivate this in their lives, because it's kind of frightening. I think it might be frightening
sure
at 60
is.
To say this is an absolutely essential part of being human that I've paid no attention to and I'm not very good at and don't know how to begin.
But, you know, it's different than trying to learn a new language or learning Chinese at 60, because Chinese isn't embedded in you, but play is.
All right.
So, you know, you got a leg up on play just by being human.
Okay.
I mean, if somebody said, you got to learn Chinese at my age, I'd look for the nearest cliff and jump.
If I think about this program, is there music or sound that might accompany this conversation? You know, we can't do visuals with radio. But.
No, I wish you could. I've done a number of conferences where before I start, I'll give everybody a baton and play about five different kinds of music, beginning with Sousa, polkas, and to some really heavy Mahler, to hard rock. And it's kind of wherever your signature is, find it and conduct it and enjoy it. But I don't know your audience well enough to know what you can. You know, there's a lot of joyful music that I think is zippy and playful.
Well, we might ask you. Colleen might ask you just to give us some suggestions, even just music you like, music you find joyful, and we might be able to use that. So we can do that by email.
All right.
I think we're. I think we've come to a good place. I don't want to ask you just before we finish. We skipped over this a bit, but it's clearly an important message in what you say, that how much or how one played as a child. I mean, how, as you look back now at your childhood, what do you see?
I see a very blessed childhood because particularly my father's family was full of practical jokers, gamers, and it was just a, they were farmers in Nebraska, but they were players first and farmers second. And it was, a large, large, raucous, involved family. And then I had with my older brother and I were fortunate enough to spend full summers with my mother's extended family, whose sisters and brother didn't take her religiosity as seriously as we did at home. So I had a playful, a lot of permission to play. And as I got into this as a, as an avocation, I realized I probably wouldn't be able to do it if I hadn't had that kind of really pretty exuberant, playful background. So I feel very lucky.
Okay, well, it's been delightful speaking with you.
You too. I would like to say one other thing, okay. And that is I hope to get all of this into form in a book, and I'm working on that, and I hope we'll get it out.
So. Oh, okay. All right. Well, we will be in touch. You and Colleen are in touch, and we may have some other questions.
Kristen.
And thank you so much.
Well, I hope the program's really workable.
Yeah, it was
and good,
great.
Good for the audience. Thank you.
All right, bye-bye.
Bye-bye.